talk to Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on FM 107.5, 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee with the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500. No one knows more, I think that's safe to say. He won't say it, I will, than Donald Davidson, who's here in the media center with us, just above the main straightaway, a couple hundred yards away from the Yard of Bricks, where we had a very eventful day today. A couple of crashes, Elio Castroneves, Pippa Mann. Luckily, both are okay. The cars are not. And quick speeds. Carlos Munoz, the fastest of the day, 230.121 miles an hour. And the NBCSN house driver, my friend Townsend Bell, was second quick today. He continues to impress year in, year out, coming in and doing just this one race a year in IndyCars. And he was second fastest today at 228.969 miles an hour. All right, the floor is yours to visit with Donald. 317-239-1070 is the telephone number, and we start with Jerry in Frankfort, Kentucky. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
How you doing, guys?
Fine.
Great.
My question tonight is I would like you to talk about the Stutz cars at the Speedway, particularly the White Squadron of 1913 and 1914.
Okay, 1915 as well?
yes.
Okay, I'll just back it up a little bit and then say that the Stutz was an Indianapolis firm, and the slogan was the car that made good in a day. And where that came from was the fact that a Stutz went 500 miles in 1911. What they actually ran was a prototype. It was a stripped-down passenger car, but they weren't ready to sell to the public yet, and so May of 1911, I think it was about July or August before you could actually buy one, but it certainly got a lot of attention, and Gail Anderson ran the loan car to finish 11th and went the full 500 miles. And then Stutz cars ran in, they had three of them in 1912, and Charlie Murs was fourth with Billy Nipper, who was an East Coast driver, drove relief. And then Len Zengel, somebody we know very little about, I believe was also a Pennsylvania driver. He finished sixth, and Billy Nipper co-drove that one as well. Gil Anderson, who was Norwegian-born, and stir it up a little bit. His name was Anderson with an E, not an O. But he always raced professionally with an O. And whether that was his decision or whether he just got fed up with trying to correct everybody or not, I don't know. But his correct name was spelt Anderson with S-E-N on the end. And he was born in Norway and would go back and visit there occasionally. Anyway, in 1913, Stutz finished third, and there's a story. They had three. Gil Anderson was running second to the Peugeot that went on to win with Jules Gou, and Anderson shared the wheel with Earl Cooper, and they were running second, and then they broke, I think, a drive shaft or rear axle or something serious broke at 187 laps when they were running second. And the other one had an adventure as well, but I'll back up. And the third car was Don Herr, who had been on the national team in 1912 and actually drove some laps of relief for Joe Dawson, who went on to win. But National withdrew from racing after the victory and said, we will rest on our laurels. So Don Herr went over to Stutz. Anyway, the third-place car, as it ended up, was Charlie Murs, with Earl Cooper co-driving on that one. But Murs was back at the wheel. And Gou won the race by a huge margin, 13 minutes and 8 seconds. And so the attention then turned to a battle for second place between Spencer Wishart in a Mercer, which was an entry from Trenton, and Charlie Murs with the Stutz that was built downtown at 10th and 11th and Senate and Capitol, that whole block of the building that Turner Woodward owns today. And so Harry Stutz was very much hands-on and was sort of like Roger Penske, where he did his own strategy. And when they came out of the turn, out of the fourth turn to come down to take the signal for one lap to go, here comes the Mercer. And then they wait and wait and wait for the Stutz. And a few seconds later, here comes the Stutz. But it's on fire. And so Harry Stutz strolls out onto the track and signals Merz to come in. And Merz ignored him and went by and thought, hey, we've only got one lap to go. Let's see if we can finish. And so they wait and wait and wait again. And then here comes the Mercer to take second place. And then, like, not too many seconds later, then here comes the Stutz, and it's still going. Flames pouring out of it. The riding mechanic was Harry Martin, who had ridden with Joe Dawson in the winning national with Don Herr the year before. And as with everybody else that worked for national, most of them went to other teams, including Harry Martin. And Harry Martin was leaning out over the bodywork and trying to beat the flames out. And the crowd went nuts because they knew it was a local entry, and because now you could go downtown and buy a Stutz to drive on the street. And so this huge cheer went up as the car goes by to take the checkered flag in third place, on fire, with the riding mechanic out trying to beat out the flames. I don't know how many people we've got like that today, but anyway. So then 1914... three cars again, Earl Cooper and Barney Oldfield, Gil Anderson, but Barney Oldfield, who some people called him the king of speed, although most of what he did was barnstorming. But when he did drive in legitimate events, he was a very capable driver, and he actually finished fifth with the Stutz. And use it with Gil Anderson, who dropped out, and then Anderson relieved him at the wheel, and so they got sixth. And Earl Cooper obviously had dropped out earlier, and Gil Anderson. So then in 1915 is, and we'll wind it up here, was the final year that Stutz ran. And by this time, the intent of the event had already altered a little bit, because it was supposed to be for stripped-down passenger cars. And after Ray Haroon won with the Marmon Wash, that was a special that the engineers built in one corner of the shop, then you started to see more not pushing of the envelope or leniency or whatever you want. It was getting further away from stripped-down passenger cars. And Harry Stutz was always pretty... committed to not having too many modifications, so that what you bought was fairly close to what you'd seen on the track. Anyway, 1915 was the first year that the cars were lined up according to qualifying speed, which was still single laps. It was the order of entry in 11 and 12. They drew. They actually drew for starting positions in 13 and 14. Hope we don't have to do that this year. And then 1915, then they went to speed, and Harry Wilcox won the pole. And there's a little story there which I will wind up with in a moment. All three of the Stutz finished the race. Gil Anderson was third with Johnny Aitken as a relief driver. And then Earl Cooper was fourth with Johnny Aitken as a relief driver. And then Howdy Wilcox, the pole winner, went it alone and finished a seventh. And then at the end of that year, Harry Stutz decided to no longer go racing. And then, in fact, it wasn't too long after that that he actually lost control of his company in a stock market coup of some kind. He was eventually ousted from the firm that he had founded. But anyway, here's the final story. Howdy Wilcox was just about ready to go out, and Harry Stutz said to him, look, you know, you put this thing on the pole, and I'll treat you to the best steak dinner you've ever had. Well, in the meantime, and this is reported in the newspapers, the next day, this is not a Wikipedia story, he said he was admiring that Howdy Wolk at that time, sorry, that Harry Sturz had a stick pin with a diamond in it. And he's eyeing that thing. So they started discussing the diamond. And then the deal became, if you put it on the pole, the diamond is yours. So he goes out and wins the pole and gets the diamond. Well, just about 2 weeks ago, on Friday, which would be Friday, May the 1st, we were in, a number of us were over in Crawfordsville because Howdy Wilcox, the 1919 winner, was born in Crawfordsville. And the organization that was just formed to put historic markers for racetracks and famous drivers, and they did Winchester Speedway, and they did where Wilbur Shaw down in Shelbyville, and I think that's the only two they did so far. So they did the Howdy Wilcox one in Crawfordsville, Friday, May 1st. And several of the relatives came in. It was really neat. Bill Shaw was there, Wilbur Shaw's son. Mm-hmm. Sonny Meyer, Louis Meyer's son, who lives in Crawfordsville. So we had the two sons of three-time winners. But I started telling that story over the PA to the group about the pin. And I noticed that lady in the front row is holding up her hand and wiggling her fingers. And it was a Howdy Wilcox, like a great niece or something like that, one of the direct family. And the diamond had been made into a ring decades ago and then handed down as an heirloom. And so she was actually wearing the thing that I was talking about, which was 100 years earlier, and just an astonishing coincidence. But anyway, I think that pretty much tells the story of the White Legion Stutz, and we thank you for the call.
Thank you, Jerry. More of your questions for Donald at 317-239-1070. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. Welcome back to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Donald Davidson. I'm Kevin Lee. Your chance to talk to Donald is now. When someone drops off, that's your cue to call 317-239-1070 for the Talk of Gasoline Alley. And up next, it's Jack in Indianapolis. Hi, Jack. You're on with Donald.
Hi, Jack.
Hi. I had a question tonight I was wondering if there had ever been any sort of on-site betting or betting on the cars to win for the winner at the racetrack at Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Any sort of like a betting window or
that's a good question.
Like that.
Okay, not officially at the track. Before World War I, you could go downtown to the betting parlors and place a wager, but it appears that it was for the manufacturers. So you didn't go down and bet on Ray Haroon. You went down and bet on Marmon.
And the however many cars that they had, the three
whatever
or four.
So they would give odds. And I think that probably went up maybe 1915 or 16, but I don't. It's not after the war. But then as far as out here or anywhere else, unofficially, there was a lot.
Okay.
I don't know even if it was strictly legal, but I remember that I used to give talks several a year where they would have, they'd have like the 33 Club, and it would be like factory or an office workers or whatever it was, and they would build a pretty good pot, and they would actually make contributions every month.
Oh, you're talking more like office pools.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
I can remember that when I was a kid in the 70s, and it was still going on in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You know, you mentioned that. I don't know if there's a lot of that going on now.
No, it's died way down. But I remember there was tons of that. And as I say, it went everywhere from, hey, you know, the family gets together and let's draw names, down to some of these that took it seriously. And as I say, they would contribute every month, and then they would have a dinner to decide who was going to have what. And then sometimes you just had the flat draw, and other times you'd bid.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to one of those. I remember in 1987 was probably one of the last ones that I did, or maybe might even be the last one that I recall of that type. And I think it was one of the country clubs. And night before the 87 race, and I happened to look, and they had this like a chalkboard or something where you could you could get on the different, and I think actually more than one person could get on a name, and nobody had bet on Al Unser. That was the year when he replaced Don Geyers. And I remember saying, look, if this hasn't closed yet, I'm not going to influence you. But Al Unser driving for Penske, even if it's a year-old car and a car's worth, Al brings him home. Could be a third, fourth, fifth place finisher. So I didn't think about him winning, but I thought there was an excellent chance that, he'd be in the first four or five.
There's now more of a form of that in fantasy. Obviously, fantasy football is the thing that we think of most. Baseball is where it started, but there are now pools online. I think IndyCar.com has ties to fantasy picks. It's more for the IndyCar season, but it also obviously applies to the Indianapolis 500. So that's the modern form of gambling, and in this case, I don't think any money changes hands. But
for a number of years, Las Vegas used to post odds. Remember that? In fact, I think Jimmy the Greek used to rate the drivers, and I don't know that he knew a lot about racing. I'm not even sure if he ever came here. But and they would tend to favor the pole sitter. Sure. Without really taking into consideration some of the other things. But I think there was Las Vegas odds were posted, in the 70s and 80s. I haven't heard of
you
that in years.
You still see odds posted. I see them on Twitter, and I don't even know if it's in America. It seems like my friend Shane in Australia often posts odds for IndyCar races each week, or maybe it's Matt at Indy 44 that finds them online somewhere. But Jack brings up something I hadn't thought of before. Horse racing is so much based on gambling at the track, other places. Why didn't auto racing become the same? Some of the early traditions of auto racing, I think, were somewhat based on horse racing. In some cases, were you not running these at the same tracks where they ran horse races back in the early days? Why did that become ensconced so much in the traditions and the success of horse racing and not in auto racing?
Well, I don't know that this was anything to do with it, but there would be so many opportunities in auto racing for
easier to fix things.
Well, or apparently.
Yeah, it's tougher to bribe a horse.
Yes, I was down on power. It wasn't handling properly or something like that.
Yeah.
Not that anybody would take a dive, but there would be that suspicion, maybe.
Okay.
So I think there was attempts to get betting going on East Coast midget racing in the 30s, and they said, no, thank you. And so other than for the being able to bet on the manufacturers, downtown Indianapolis pre-World War I, officially, I think that's probably about the extent of it.
Well, I know Randy Bernard, who was the CEO of IndyCar a few years ago through 2012, he made some efforts to get IndyCar races on the boards in Vegas casinos, with the thinking being that and we've seen that again in the NFL when people have something online, whether it's even if it's not real money, if it's just pride, they have more interest. So the idea there is if we get people to put something down on these races, they're more likely to watch. But I think he had one book that was doing it for a while, but it didn't ever really catch on. Good question, Jack. Thank you for your call. 317-239-1070 is the telephone number. And Chris in Mexico, Missouri is up with us next. Hi, Chris.
Hi,
Chris.
Gentlemen. How y'all doing?
Fine, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Mastin Gregory was finally elected to the Missouri Sports Hall of Fame about 2 years ago, which is awesome. But a couple other Missouri drivers, which I don't really know too much about, would be Frank Elliott and Bobby Wente. Just wondering if you could fill us in a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. Frank Elliott was from Lathrop, Missouri, and I don't know why I remember that, but he was Louis Meyer's mentor. Louis Meyer went on to win the 500 three times, and I remember he was always talking about Frank Elliott. Frank Elliott was at Indianapolis in 1916 for the first time, but he's thought pretty much of as a driver of Millers in the 1920s. He was sixth in 1923, driving a Durant Special, which was actually a Miller. And this is coincidental because it was financed by Cliff Durant. And I thought after we went after the first segment, and I was talking about the White Legion Sturts, Cliff Durant owned a car that finished second in 1919, called the Durant Special with Eddie Hearn driving, and it was actually one of those 1915 Sturts. Anyway, back onto what we're supposed to be talking about, which is Frank Elliott. He was sixth in 1923, and then also 6th in 1926, 10th in 27 with relief drivers. And he was successful on board tracks. And he wasn't somebody that would win a great deal, but he was sort of a regular that would finish in the first 4 or 5. And But probably the thing that I think of most about Frank Elliott was the fact that Louis Meyer was a mechanic for him. And Louis was, if not his protege, I think that Louis thought of Frank Elliott as the guy that got him into to racing. Now, Bob Wente, we would jump several decades to the 1960s. And he was from Normandy, Missouri, which is basically St. Louis. His forte was midget car racing, and he won the USAC Midget Championship in 1963, but he'd been runner-up to Jimmy Davies in 1960, 61, and 62. And his first year at Indianapolis, he was here several years and just had the one start. In 60, he took part of his rookie test with the Safety Autoglass Special, which is the car that used to be on the roof at Southeastern Avenue. And by the way, I don't know if I've mentioned this on any night, but somebody told me, they said, since the car's off the roof now, and Gary Schroeder and Chris Paulson say they're restoring it, but I would think they would have quite a task ahead of them. somebody said, I think that place is closed. I've driven by there a couple of times, and it looks like it is vacated. So, sadly, the Safety Autoglass business on Southeastern, you can go by. The building's still there, but there's no business, and the car's not on the roof anymore. Anyway, Bobby Wente was in 1961. He had the Drury Special, didn't make it. 63, he was in several cars, the Hoover, the Eve Hoover's car with Joe Langley, and I think he was also in the Travelon trailer car when people used to jump back and forth between cars. And then in 1964, finally made it, and a Watson chassis, and it was called the Moorcroft Taylor Special, and it was Gil Moorcroft, who was a Philadelphia attorney, big racing fan, and Ralph Taylor, who was, I think, a Chevy dealer over in central Illinois somewhere. And Bob Higman was the mechanic, and as he was on the cars that Bob Wente drove in midgets, drove for the Shannon brothers, amongst others. And very often Bob Higman was the mechanic. Anyway, they qualified in 64. And they were running at the end. They didn't go the full 500 miles, but they were flagged off in ninth place. He didn't get Rookie of the Year because Johnny White was fourth, and Bob Harkey was eighth ahead of him. But he did get a top 10 finish. He was back for the next 3 years and made qualifying attempts. In fact, and even in 1967, A.J. Foyt gave him a shot. And he made an attempt, but had to wave off, and then just went back to running midgets. He would run sprint cars occasionally, had a couple of poles. In fact, the very first sprint car race I ever went to was on May the 30th, 1965, because the 500 would not run. That's back when the 500 would run on the 30th, regardless of the day of the week on which it fell, except for Sunday, in which case it would go to Monday, May the 31st, which it did in 65. And so Pete Wales, who was the promoter up at Winchester in those days, had a sprint race. And so the sprint car regulars obviously were up there. And then the people who would normally drive sprint cars but had a 500 ride, they would be precluded from running because of the 24-hour rule. And the car that Bobby Unser would normally drive was available. Mm-hmm. And so Bob Wente drove. Don Shepard was the mechanic, and he had the fastest qualifying time. But that's the two drivers that you asked about. There were some other Missouri drivers, but Frank Elliott and Bob Wente were the two that you asked about.
Thank you, Chris. More of your questions for Donald coming up. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway on FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. I'm Kevin Lee. The star of the show is Donald Davidson, and you can ask Donald a question. The next time someone hangs up, jump on board, and you can call in. Isaac on the west side is up next. Hi, Isaac.
How you doing this evening?
Isaac, you're
good
up,
evening,
Donald.
Hello. How are you, sir?
Okay. The question I had was the drivers who raced in the 500 who became a broadcaster driver analysis on radio and TV. I know some of them, but I'd like to know about all the ones that, that you can remember that went into that.
If they drove in the 500, there's quite a few of those. Maury Rose was the driver expert in 1955. We'll start with the radio network. And so Fred Agabashian, Len Sutton, Davey Hamilton. I don't know. Pippa Mann has done a 500, I think, or a couple. I know I've done some races with her, but I don't know if it's a 500 or not.
I don't
not.
Know if Pippa's done the 500 because she might have been driving in it each year. She's done some other IndyCar races.
Roger Ward, Gordon Johncock, Johnny Rutherford, Derek Daly, Mike Hiss.
Here's one for you.
This is just 500 network only, yeah.
I think it was last year. Robbie Buell.
Oh, he was terrific.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Yes, he was. I thought he was outstanding.
Uh-huh.
That's all I can think of, but that's not to say that's all of them for the 500 network. And then as far as TV, Bobby Unser, Sam Posey, Scott Goodyear, Eddie Cheever.
Jackie Stewart.
Jackie Stewart, for heaven's sake, yes. Jan Beekhuis drove championship cars, but never in the 500. He ran mm-hmm. Long Beach, I remember being one. And now I don't know where we would draw the line here. Are we just doing championship races or?
Yeah, I think you'd talk about IndyCar drivers.
All right, then. But other events, I'm thinking. That's all I can think of at the moment for network.
You said Tom Sneva?
I did not say Tom Sneva.
Okay.
Yeah, Tom Sneva.
Did you say Ari Lyon?
Ari Lyon.
He did broadcasts on Fox for a while.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, Townsend Bell.
Oh, yes, also. No,
although
terrific.
This question
yes.
may be if you're thinking just the 500. Townsend has not worked the 500 on television. Jason Priestley was a broadcaster before he was an Indy Lights.
In 500.
Before he was an Indy Lights driver.
I think the gentleman specified 500 drivers only, I think.
Yeah.
All right, that's all I can think of at the moment. I hope it didn't anybody.
I know we're missing a few, but broadcasting the 500, he is not. Paul Tracy, obviously, is now a television broadcaster who drove in the 500. Thinking just simply on the 500 broadcast.
It's hard. I don't want to let go because I know that I'll take my finger and thumb off the
pawn. You said Larry Rice?
I did not say Larry Rice.
Okay.
Yes.
That's definitely one.
Larry Rice.
And Larry was on the 500 broadcast.
He was on the international feed, I think, wasn't he?
Was he ever on the ABC main broadcast?
I don't think so.
He did the international feed. For other IndyCar races, and I don't know if he was for the 500 night, but you're definitely right that he and Gary Lee did the international broadcast.
I did one at Michigan, which was an independent thing, with Big Jim Wilson was the anchor, and I was on that, and Art Pollard was the driver expert. That was the Michigan 200. In fact, the day that Merle Bettenhausen got hurt.
Well, I'm sure someone will tweet us some of those that we've forgotten, and we will add to the list as we go on this evening. But that's a pretty good list of it,
all right,
I think. And if you think it, you think of something else.
All right, then.
Good question. Thank you, Isaac. 317-239-1070 is the number. Donald in Richmond, Virginia is next with Donald Davidson.
Hi, Donald.
Hi, Donald. I wonder if you could tell us about Frank Fiore's Indianapolis 500 efforts tonight.
Oh, how long have we got? This is one of my favorite stories about the Speedway. I don't know. Frank Fiore, I'll try and do this in a few minutes. I think this is a terrific story. And Frank Fiore was owned midgets in the Northwest for a number of years. BCRA, Bay Cities Racing Association, it would run USAC up the West Coast occasionally. And he wanted to run the Indianapolis 500 as a car owner. He was a mechanic for United Airlines, I think it was. He was based at San Francisco, and he entered a car in 1968. This is one of my favorite operations of all time. It was an old Huffacre chassis with a stock block Chevy, and it was called Speedy's Broasted Chicken Special. And it wasn't a chain. That was Speedy's was his. It was a chicken place that his sister operated. Anyway, they were here in '68 and '69. Missed the show both times. Never made a nickel. Chuck Booth was the driver in '68, and Dave Strickland tried it in '69, and D. Jones was in it, and they just couldn't get it running fast enough to even justify a qualifying attempt. So anyway, in '70, he didn't come back. This is Frank Fiore. 1971, he decided, let's have another go at this. And so this story, I think, is absolutely phenomenal. It sounds like it's made up. It is not. He bought a wrecked Volstead chassis. In fact, it had been, it was the car that Billy Foster was involved in the first lap accident in 1966. The car was repaired, and I think it got crashed a couple of other times, and he actually bought it wrecked for $2,500. He bought the chassis for $2,500. He got an engine from J.C. Agajanian. It was a turbo offie, also $2,500, with the turbocharger unit. There was something about, and I'm not a gearhead, but there was like a head or some part that he had to buy that was $3,000. And so far, that was the most expensive part of the proposition. Denny Zimmerman was the driver. They needed a hauler. They got a trailer and a hauler that was like a drag racing pickup truck with a six-person cab. Hooked the whole lot up and towed it back to Indianapolis with Frank and his wife and his son, Frank Jr., who I still talk to occasionally, who was 15 at the time, and then another kid that they took out of school that was also 15. And San Carlos, California, I think, is where they were from, which was like up around the San Francisco area. So I'm not making this up. So they entered the car, bought it back, and they made the show. And, I've only got 1 minute. It'll have to be a two-parter then. Can we come back and finish up?
Because we can.
It's a great story. Well, just tell me when I need to wrap on this segment.
Well, since we've already interrupted you, we might as well go ahead and do it now. And we'll finish up with some others we forgot. How could we forget our friend Johnny Parsons?
I got about it. Didn't I mention him?
Maybe you did.
I think I did.
Maybe you did. Poncho Carter?
I didn't mention Poncho. I got about another 3-4 minutes on this story.
Let you have it at the end. You can take the rest of the show and talk about this if you like.
Then,
but we do
good.
Have to take a break. In 10 seconds,
okay.
And I know you can't tell me anything else in 10 seconds, but we can say Danny Sullivan. Danny Sullivan has been a broadcaster before.
Sure.
Larry Rice was, according to Matt Lake in 500, and I think he's right, on the ABC broadcast in 2001.
Really?
And John McKenna asks about Howdy Holmes. I don't know.
I don't remember Howdy doing a race.
About that. He mentions Derek Daly. I know you mentioned Derek.
Derek was on the radio
and
broadcast
here's
once.
One. Mm-hmm. I knew there was someone that was an Indy Lights driver before he was an IndyCar driver. I think James Hinchcliffe did the radio broadcast with us 1 year before he was an IndyCar driver.
I don't remember him doing it.
That rings a bell. I remember there was an Indy Lights driver who did the broadcast filling in for Davey, and then eventually became an IndyCar driver. So I will trust Scott, who mentioned that one. All right, we'll get back and let Donald finish up in just a moment. It's the Talk of Gasoline Alley on FM 107.5, 1070 The Fan. One more driver analyst mentioned that Tom sent in. He said a little bit off the beaten path. Billy Scott.
Yeah, he's absolutely right.
From the 1970s. All right, please continue.
Okay, back on Frank Fiore. So they head back to Indianapolis with the Volstead repaired and the turbo off. He fixed up on the back of the trailer, and Frank and his wife and Frank's son and a classmate that was also 15 years old, they come back here, and they spent the entire month. Their accommodation for the month was the truck. They slept in the garage area, and Frank said that at nighttime they'd wait till, you know, 8-9 o'clock. He said, I know Clarence Cagle knew what we were doing, but he said we'd just sneak the boys into the bathroom in the garage area so they could brush their teeth, and then we'd sleep in the truck, and they'd go, you know, get White Castles and stuff like that. Anyway, the thing is that, you know, it was a real shoestring and a wing and a prayer, but they made it. That's the important thing. I mean, they didn't just sort of have a go and miss it. They made the show. And 71 was a tough one to make because McElreath and Donnie Allison both got bumped. In fact, McElreath got bumped twice. And Art Pollard was bumped and got back in another car. Jerry Grant, Sam Posey all posted times and didn't make it. And Denny Zimmerman with a Fiore car did. Again, the race... They didn't have a spare set of wheels. They had to go to another. They went to a fellow named Don Murgard and borrowed a set of wheels because Denny Zimmerman said, he said, the only thing we've got more than one of is wheels. We got four of those, but they had to borrow a set. And then, as it turns out, they didn't need them because he ran so not conservatively, but he ran very steadily. And the tire wear in those days was such that they never had to change a tire. He stopped, I think, like, you know, four times for fuel only. And the attrition in those days, that was back when the 500 was like an enduro and cars would drop out. They'd have accidents or they'd blow up. And then you would have the survivors at the end. He did 189 laps and he was flagged off eighth. And he won the Rookie of the Year. And Penske, both the Penske cars with Mark Donahue and David Hobbs were... Neither one of them finished. So, anyway, all said and done.
There you just mentioned another that's become a broadcaster, although he's not done this race, Hobbs.
Oh, golly, yes. David Hobbs drove in the 500.
And David's my friend.
I don't know that he's ever done the 500.
No, I don't think he has.
Yeah. So, anyway, there was some other stuff as well. They needed to have some work done. There was a fellow named Joe Baker that had a little machine shop down on Tibbs, and he said, look, I'll tell you what, Frank, I'll do the work for you, you've made the show, you're in the show, and then you can pay me out of the prize money, which Frank did. Anyway, Frank said that he figured out that on race morning, and this is unbelievable to think now, eighth place prize money in 1971 was $28,000, and Frank said that he estimated on race morning that his entire expenditure was $18,000 for the car, the engine, and even the hauler and the trailer to bring it back with, plus their accommodations, which was zero because they slept in the truck. It was fun back then. And how great that actually here's this guy driving home, and he made a profit. Now, how many people could do that?
Thank you for the call. Mike Thompson, who we trust him as a source, right?
He's got a bunch of drivers that we missed.
Well, no, he confirms what I thought. James Hinchcliffe did do the radio network, and Newgarden did that Las Vegas race in 2011. I remember that one. So thank you for that. Mary Barker, did you mention Kevin Cogan? Was he an announcer?
I don't remember Kevin Cogan doing a race. Not here. Not radio network, at least.
No, I think he's... She's talking in general.
Yeah.
John says, I confused Howdy Holmes with Howdy Bell. Howdy Bell, who I just saw today, was not a driver, but a long-time announcer. But Howdy was here as well. Brian, yes, he mentioned Sam Posey. And Sam did start in the 500.
Yeah, he did.
Several times.
One start. He was 1972,
just one time? Okay.
But he finished fifth.
And, of course, our friend Dan Weldon, who did not broadcast this race, but did several races with us on NBCSN in 2011 as well. All right, we've got 2 minutes. Who can be in 2 minutes? We'll give Paula in Westfield an opportunity. Go ahead, Paula.
Hi, Paula.
Thank you so much. Hello, Donald. It's a real honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm calling because my adult son and I attended the race last Saturday, and he unfortunately became ill. The yellow shirts and the medical staff were awesome. We went to the Enfield Hospital, and I'm sitting there wondering, I go, this looks like it was built in the 50s. And I thought, what did they do before that, and when was it built?
It was actually built in 1947. And I think that the hospital is now the oldest thing that you can see on the grounds, because everything else has been replaced. So the original double-deck grandstands in Turn 1 are still there. But I think the Enfield Hospital, which is started out with just basic cinder blocks, and it just looked like a barn in the early days, and it's still the original building. But now, you know, as you went in and saw, very high tech with the very best of equipment and the very best of care. But 1947. What did they do before that? They had a building that was at the east end of the garage area, the old garage area when it went from east to west. And then they would have first aid tents set up around the place. But there was always a medical facility here right back to the very beginning in 1909.
All right. Thank you, Paula. We appreciate it. Thanks to everyone who joined in. Apologies to those who did not get through, but we'll try again tomorrow night. Donald will be in the studio. Kurt and I will be at the Grill at Geist on Fall Creek for Trackside, and I'll stay there. I might be eating dinner during the second hour of the program, but that's okay. All I have to do is say, so-and-so is on with Donald, and then I'll be ready
for 15 minutes.
And then it's time for a break. All right, thanks to everyone who helped out tonight and participated in the show. Skylar Wood, our on-site engineer. Casey Vallier back at the studio. He'll have the podcast up at 1070thefan.com in just a few minutes. Thanks for joining us. Another great day today at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Track open tomorrow from noon until 6. This is FM 107.5 and 1070 The Fan.